and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
For those who often put this one on, and it's not going. It should be aux one.
Of technical difficulties as per usual with Bill and I.
Well, we're in the new studio here with the new equipment here. So good. So Casey, that's
good evening. Thanks for your patience. Welcome to the Capital District DSA Good Time Hour. You're listening to us on station WGXC on your dial at 90.7, now located in both Caro or Acra and its new studio at 393 Main Street in Catskill. I'm Casey and I'm here with Poche Noir.
And that rather stirring music was the theme song to Combat, which any boomer like myself would fondly recognize. I imagine, Casey, your dad would recognize that.
Oh,
music.
I'm sure.
Okay, that show starred one of my favorite actors, Vic Morrow, who would later be manslaughtered by John Landis in violation of labor laws on the set of the Twilight Zone movie. So, starting with Combat, tonight's show will be all about American militarism and how we're all conditioned to accept it. And Casey and I are both members of the Democratic Socialists of America, so I'm going to allow Casey to give the necessary disclaimer.
Yes, sorry.
That's okay.
The opinions and remarks made on this program are our own and not those of WGXC nor of the DSA specifically. We are just a couple of socialists and members of the Democratic Socialists of America speaking our minds. The DSA intentionally is a big tent.
That's right. You do not have to be a strict Marxist as I am. Okay. So we have two special guests tonight. One is our comrade Peter Warren, and tonight is a special night because this is the August 6th being the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, one of the, I guess, most terrible examples or instances of militarism. And Peter has some thoughts about that subject. Peter, lay it on us.
Thanks, great to be here again, and hello everybody in Radio Land. So just first clarification, by August 6, 1945, the Japanese had not surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that. They wouldn't surrender formally until 9 days later by declaration of the emperor. So I guess, as a socialist and leftist, I've always taken issue with our general viewpoint on Hiroshima, and it seems to me there's a whole belief that there is somehow a good, non-disastrous, non-catastrophic option to end the war with Japan, mm-hmm. and the world in general, war in general, and somehow by not choosing that good option, that our leaders were monstrous criminals with all kinds of nefarious intent, and instead of, in my view, Americans in 1945 in leadership positions doing what you pretty much expect them to do, and not necessarily inhuman monsters for using this. So, I thought I'd just go through the time we've got, the options in front of the U.S. leadership, mm-hmm. what their analysis was of these options, their experience of the war so far, how that came into the decision making, and also about the Japanese on their side. And I think that in every case, you want an explanation for this that's going to be worthwhile and true as possible and useful. And I don't think what I just said is really that useful. Hopefully this will shed some light on it. So, okay, what are the options available to the United States in August of 1945? You could blockade the home islands, which you had the power to do. Japanese population, about 72 million, was already on the brink of starvation. Their trade had been cut off. U.S. bombing up to this point had demolished their ability to supply food to the people. And what we were looking at is blockade them and starve them to cause surrender. The question is, we'll get back to this in a minute, would that cause the Japanese to surrender? So, meanwhile, our naval and air forces are suffering attrition from the Japanese kamikaze efforts, submarines, et cetera, et cetera. So that's something that military planners had to take into account, for sure. So that's catastrophic option number one.
Mm-hmm.
Catastrophic option number two is an invasion of the home islands. Right, okay, so the Japanese have made plans for this, and their general concept for this is 100 million die proudly. And that is basically a mass suicide of the Japanese population, an immolation of the whole country.
Did you say probably or proudly?
Proudly, mm-hmm. Okay. 100 million die proudly in defense of Dai Nippon, their culture and civilization. So to that point, they had mobilized 25% of the civilian population. That's about 18 to 20 million people. They had 3.5 million Japanese troops on the home islands. 12,500 aircraft, which had a 7-month supply of aviation gasoline, so that's a lot of kamikazes.
Well, you did a lot of research for this show.
I did.
Okay. And press on.
He's asking.
That's my thing, all right? Suicide motorboats and submarines. And, what did U.S. military and political planners expect to happen? They could assume that this would be like Iwo Jima or Okinawa, previous engagements,
mm-hmm.
an order of magnitude worse, like catastrophic. So Iwo Jima, 21,000 Japanese defenders, 260 survived,
mm-hmm.
mostly badly wounded. Okinawa, 130,000 defenders, 110,000 dead, about 8,000 prisoners, most of whom were native Okinawans. So what we'd experienced, what the United States had experienced, was Japanese soldiers and units willing to commit virtual mass suicide in the spirit of taking as many American lives with them as possible. So kick this up 1,000 miles. What are the projections for the invasion of the Japanese home islands? Okinawa is actually part of Japan politically, but now you got the rest of the home islands. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, one, catastrophic losses for the U.S. military. Two, the reasonable expectation that the Japanese civilian population will fight alongside the Japanese army as they had in Okinawa and other places, and that the Japanese would not surrender until absolutely decimated. So you're looking at maybe not the complete destruction of the Japanese people, but it's going to be an Okinawa-type situation, mm-hmm. which is an unimaginable catastrophe. So, President Truman, General Marshall, Admiral King. General Marshall had done the official study of Operation Olympic, the invasion of the home islands, and he presented all this data that I presented to you, presenting to you guys, to the president, and it's like,
But hadn't he done that after they had made sufficient progress to know they could make a bomb as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
the bomb was there.
There's the point.
They had already intended to do
there's
that.
There's the point. Well, it's like, you've got a bomb, you've made it at the cost of extraordinarily lots of billions of dollars.
Well, two bombs.
Two bombs,
least.
Actually, and four more in the pipeline. Yeah. So you've got two catastrophic options, and I would argue it's rolling the dice, a disastrous one, with atomic bombs being used. And from the standpoint of U.S. military and political planners in 1945, what are you going to roll with? Try the atomic bomb, see if they work, to bring the war to a speedy conclusion, or prolonged blockade, the worst campaign of World War II in terms of loss of life on both sides.
Well, I can see that when you're in a conference and you present those numbers like that, all it is really just a selling point. That's a dog and pony show to drop the bomb.
But still, when you put this all on the table, considering this is the U.S. military,
mm-hmm.
it's not the Dalai Lama, it's not Gandhi, it's not Jesus of Nazareth. These are Americans in 1945 mm-hmm. who have fought the Japanese for 4 years, mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor, the Bataan Death March, all the engagements we were talking about, and seen the Japanese, of course, through a racist lens. We know that's true. I mean, you can look at U.S. propaganda, but also the factual brutality and murderousness and ruthlessness of how the Japanese fought the war. And ask the Chinese about that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And parenthetically, the war is still ongoing in China, and thousands of Chinese civilians being killed per day by the Japanese through their completely scorched earth policy there. So, there's the context. But on the Japanese side, right? Here's the chronology.
Your water bottle looks incredibly like a bomb.
Bill, it's not true.
Okay.
So, again, the dropping the bombs looks like, of all the options available, which are not plentiful, the best one. And again, American leaders, let's be clear, in 1945, American leaders or the American population don't have a whole lot of compassion left over for the Japanese. Not really.
Oh.
All right. Did they ever? Probably not. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But still, at the end of 4 years of war against this particular opponent, then we've seen how they fought.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The context of What would American leaders do in 1945 after the experience they had, the facts on the table, and it turned out their absolutely correct assessment that the Japanese weren't the surrendering kind. The Japanese leadership did not want to surrender if they could help it.
Well, there wasn't a guarantee that even after Nagasaki that they would surrender,
right.
But
and
they
here
did.
We go. So the B6, this is the Big Six, this is the Supreme War Council, six members, mostly military. After the Potsdam Declaration on July 27th, which had called for the unconditional surrender of Japan, there had been no response from the Japanese. Okay, so the Allies are saying the Japanese are blowing us off. There's no conversation here. Hiroshima happens 79 years ago today. No reaction from them. It turns out, as you learned afterwards, they were deadlocked. The emperor did not want to step in to break the tie. They're deadlocked 3-3 on continuing the war and suffering invasion or blockade instead of surrendering. August 9th, even worse, the Soviets declare war on Japan. So that means the Japanese Empire is now done. The Soviets are going to come in and take all of the territories in China and Manchuria. And Nagasaki happens. Still, at the end of that day, they're split 3-3. The emperor still won't come in. On the 10th, the emperor breaks the tie and says, we have to, my dear, wonderful people are going to suffer so much. We have to accept their terms of unconditional surrender. But the proposal by the Japanese government to the Allies still contains conditions about the emperor. The emperor has to stay in power, blah, 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 blah. The Allies at that point, again, no compassion, not much compassion in 1945 for the Japanese. And the Allies want Imperial Japan destroyed, as Nazi Germany had been destroyed. Not keeping them in power under some conditions, not this or that, they're going to be destroyed. So we're saying to the Japanese, you have to bend the knee and accept surrender with no conditions. We're going to decide how the emperor ends up, right? The emperor has, by the 10th, has agreed to that, but there's still conditions. Next step is B-29 bombers drop leaflets all over Japan explaining the Allies' position as of the Potsdam Declaration and the Japanese government's response as to that. So the Japanese government thinks, oh, they know what we're doing. Now our population knows what we're doing. And with that, there's been a bombing halt since the 6th after Hiroshima. Of the regular conventional bombing by the B-29s, Truman then orders the largest American strike ever on Japan with bombs, right?
Conventional bombs,
1,000 aircraft, all right? Leveling what hasn't been leveled Japan, and what had been destroyed before that is just unbelievable, what Tokyo looked like. That, by the way, knocked out the last remaining oil refinery in Japan, so now they're left without that. After that, the emperor says, finally dropping conditions, we will unconditionally surrender, we'll accept the Allied terms. And then on August 15th, he made the famous broadcast to Japanese people about how, in a very, euphemistic sort of way, we have to take this after valiant resistance. But that's not the end of the story. At the same time, there's a military coup brewing where the militaristic officers who wanted to fight to the end, 100 million proudly die, right? Trying to assassinate the peaceniks on the Big Six. Having taken control, then they'll muscle the emperor into rescinding the declaration and continue fighting with the consequences we've talked about before. That's a militaristic group right there. So they failed. The army officers in the cabinet managed to avert that. And so the August 15th statement by the emperor stood. And I do have a dog in this fight because United States Navy Ensign Junior Grade, Edgar William Warren, communications officer aboard USS LST-718, was going to be carrying the Marines in Japan for the first wave. As it was, he ended up being in Tokyo Bay when the surrender was signed, aboard the Missouri, and was in the first wave of Allied personnel along with the Marines to go ashore in Tokyo. So
I have a dog in this fight, too.
Yeah.
My dad was on Okinawa doing mop-up there, and he was ready. He was one of the people who was going to be in the first assault on Japan.
Right.
As a matter of fact, if you look at a History Channel documentary, there's film footage of my dad taking a shower in some jungly spot with all the rest of his soldiers, all the rest of the soldiers looking at him. So, and you're forbidden to comment on the homoerotic nature of that.
Just wiping off the smell of the dead, you know? Wiping off the maggots.
God, how bleak.
Yeah.
I mean, it just all. Just so much flippancy for human life in all of these wars. But it's interesting, like, hearing about the historical wars that America has fought. And arguably, I think, like, World War II is probably the one that people can look at and be like, okay, this was a noble cause. But dudes in the military have been chasing that high ever since.
That's right.
And just been destroying people across the world.
The popular understanding of World War II has been used to justify so much baloney.
And, like, we'll get to our next guest, who's Donnie, but, like, somebody... Kids watching World War II films or hearing from their dads or grandpas and then joining up and then being 18, not knowing how to tie their shoes and ending up going across killing people for no noble cause to a certain
extent. This show is going to be very, very tight for time, but let me play you an advertisement from my youth. You ready? Say, what are we doing here?
As for making soap on the land of the sea in the air.
TV's new hero is G.I. Joe. And just look at all the authentic G.I. Joe equipment you can get. Machine gun, tent, rifle, high-altitude helmet, frogman suit. You can build hundreds of exciting battle action scenes, but don't try to get everything at once. Look, when you get the bivouac set, sandbags, and the helmet package, you can set up G.I. Joe's soldier action for hours of fun. When you get the command post box, you'll have a 45 pistol with holster, a field radio, field telephone, map and map case, and a waterproof poncho. Start collecting official G.I. Joe equipment and get the official G.I. Joe footlocker, so you can keep your uniforms and equipment in it. G.I. Joe, it's a Hasbro toy.
Wow, so that's a blast from my youth there.
Nostalgia.
Yeah.
Memory lane.
So Casey, do you want to give us a little bit of an intro to our next guest, who is actually a recorded guest?
Yeah, we interviewed Donovan last week ahead of time because he wasn't available tonight. It's a pretty heavily edited interview at this
point. I'm sorry.
Just because of time. So if you want the full interview, just reach out to us at Capital District DSA, and we can send it to you. But Donovan is an Army veteran. He's a coworker of mine, a dear friend, and we can jump into that.
Okay, let's go for it. So we're here on this Tuesday with... Casey, your special friend, Donovan.
My special friend.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sounds so weird.
The line cut.
So give him an introduction.
Yes, this is my special friend, Donovan.
Hello, everybody.
But he's got a good he's got a great voice for radio.
And a great face for radio.
Oh, thank you guys.
No, mine was an insult.
Oh yeah. Great. Oh, that's right. Yeah, I'm clearly unfamiliar.
And the theme of tonight's broadcast being things military. Donnie is a veteran.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Yeah. So I joined the Army right out of high school. The area that I lived in, there weren't a lot of opportunities. There wasn't really a Fort Worth, Texas. And there's not really, got the stockyards, you know, but not everybody can be a cowboy and go to the rodeo. And so I was kind of weighing out my options, and they offered us like a free semester of community college. And I was like thinking about it, and I was like, well, you know, should I go to college? Should I do this? I was talking to my dad about it, and I was like, hey, like, you know, could I use your GI Bill? Because he was, like, going to, like, P PGA golf school and stuff, and like all these like ridiculous things. And I'm just like, you're not actually going to like, you know, college and stuff like that. So like, could I use it? And he's like, no, you can get your own. Okay. And so that kind of started my journey for like trying to find a military branch. Recruiter found me in the cafeteria at school, and that's what kind of started the journey. Yeah. But honestly, it was a really interesting experience, both joining and getting out and rejoining the civilian world. I feel like especially if you go right out of high school, because you go from being a child to going into this, like, basically the DMV with guns. You know what I mean? Like, there's long lines. There's lots of waiting. Mm-hmm.
And you're getting yelled at.
Yeah, you're getting yelled at. Nobody's in a good mood, and understandably so. None of the chairs are comfortable. You don't get to sit in them. You get to look at them. You know, and your feet always hurt. But whenever you get back into regular society, it's actually funny. They have a program whenever you're exiting the military that tries to get you ready to rejoin society with civilians. And you go and you do, like, these different workshops and stuff, and it's mostly just trying to find a career for whenever you get out, because the issue is you have these people right out of high school, and they have a lot of these skills, and not all of them are applicable to the civilian world. For example, I was in field artillery. You know, you can't do field artillery in the regular world. You know what I mean? That's not, like, you can use...
Okay, when I hear field artillery, I think geometry and ballistics.
Actually, yes, that was part of what I did. That's what the higher-ranking people in my... it's usually called a squad, but if you're artillery, it's called a section. In my section, the higher-ranking people would calculate where and how the artillery rounds would be reaching their target once we received the fire missions. I was usually on the radio or stuck in a mud hole on the 50 cal waiting for somebody from another unit.
50 cal machine gun.
Yes, yeah, 50 caliber machine gun. That was my cuddle buddy and my best friend my first few years in the military, because the lowest ranking guy usually has the least broken body, you know? And, you know, it's not really hazing, but, you know, the younger guys, you got to make them do a lot of the work. You know, it's very taxing on the body. And so that was my job whenever we got out there, because the reality of calculating it's basically a 90-pound projectile full of TNT, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can put it through a window from, like, 20 miles away if you know what you're doing. And so that's why we have higher-ranking people that have been doing the job for a while. They would actually be calculating the missions and firing the missions. As for me and my other lower enlisted friends, we were spending time digging fighting positions and waiting for an invisible enemy to come out of the woods, or somebody from another unit that would basically run out of the woods and fire blanks at you. You'd fire blanks back at them.
Mm-hmm.
You
know.
This all training?
Yeah, this was all training.
What years are we talking about?
So I joined in 2014. I got out in 2017.
And you didn't.
No, I didn't resign. You know, your actual experience you get depends on the people that you work with, the unit that you go to, the base that you go to. There's, like, a million different things. And in my experience, I thought that I was going to join a very professional organization. I thought I was going to learn a lot. I thought I was going to have strong leaders to learn from. You know, hearing all these stories my father told me growing up, you know, he was in the military. Mm-hmm. He was in Iraq. Was kind of expecting all of these surreal experiences, and the reality of what I got was about 3 years of sitting in a swamp in Georgia waiting for a fake enemy to come out of the woods and mostly sweeping parking lots. And a lot of the leadership, whenever you're not in an active, like, wartime role, things get crazy on military bases. There's a lot of domestic disputes and things mm-hmm. like that in the barracks with other soldiers and in the housing especially. There's a story. So during Hurricane Matthew, right? This is 2015?
I don't remember.
You guys don't remember Hurricane Matthew?
In Georgia?
It was in Georgia. I was stationed in Savannah, outside of Savannah.
What was the name of the base?
Fort Stewart. And, we had this hurricane roll in, and it was supposed to be this huge thing. And so all of the families were evacuated. I was, like, pulling gate guard for some training thing that was happening, so I had to stay. And so I had to stay back, and the person who lived across from me, never spoke to him a day in my life, right? And he was an MP, which is a military police officer. And once all the families left, I was sitting outside, you know, and I was... smoking a cigarette, and I was kind of just looking around. And, you know, before, like, a big storm, there's always, like, a calm, especially down south. It kind of, like, cools down and stuff like that, and the winds start blowing in. And he was sitting there doing the same thing, And he waved at me, and I waved at him, you know, and we got talking. And he's like, hey, you want to have a beer? And I was like, yeah, sure. And having a beer quickly progressed from, hey, so would you like to get, like, some women in drugs over here? And I, at the time, like, I had my wife, and I had, like, my newborn daughter who were in another state because of the hurricane. And I was like, yeah, no. And so instead, I just watched him.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, no. Like, no, buddy. I was like, no, I'm okay.
But
like,
you're
maybe
also afraid to disagree with him. Yeah, you started off with yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so, you know, you wanna let these people down lightly, especially whenever you've just met them and they, you know, they just give you this insane proposition where you're just like, oh, like, this is why I've never spoken to you in, like, the year I've lived here. So he's, you know, and so instead he's like, all right. So he starts trying to make, like, these, like, they're not, like, actual, like, bombs, but he's just trying to make, like, water bottles, like, pop open with, like, drain cleaner or something, and I'm just, like, watching him go and stuff. And so he decides instead he's going to start hitting golf balls up the street, and I remember I asked him, I was like, hey, man, I think somebody's going to call the cops. Like, maybe you should chill out. And he's like, nah, man, my buddies are going to show up? And I was just like, all right. Like, that's, you know, and like I said, that's not everybody's experience, you know, but if there are other veterans hearing this, I'm sure they have their own wild stories of mm-hmm. things that happened, like, while you're on the military base, you know, and the stuff that you run into, like, the stuff, my unit didn't deploy, but we were supposed to deploy 3 separate times, and so we went to pre-deployment training, we had to get our passports, we got all the shots, we got all the stuff.
Did you know where you're going to deploy for?
Yes. So we had 3 separate missions that we lost, basically, just because of politics and stuff like that. Other units were ready, or the mission changed, or the first place we were supposed to go to was Africa. I'm not entirely sure what the mission was there. I think we were supposed to go there for training, and we were just going to help. And so we were going to go do that. That got scrubbed. We were going to go to Iraq. That was very quickly kind of thrown out. But the real serious one that we really were training for was Afghanistan. And since we were field artillery, we were what's considered light artillery. And so there are cannons that can be picked up by Chinook helicopters and placed in different areas. And the thing about the geography of Afghanistan was that the mountains are so high up that it's actually really hard to shoot over them. And so it's much easier to just place guns on top of the mountains and then shoot missions from there and then fly them out to be able to provide fire support for maneuver units. So basically what that means is whenever our guys go out, do their job on their mission, if they start getting attacked or something bad happens, they can call us, and then we'll start, you know, doing what we need to do to make sure they can get back to base. You know, and that all sounds well and great, right? Sounds great. So the reality of it for what me and my guys were going to do is we were what was referred to as ADVON, or advance party. And so, you know, these artillery pieces cost, like, way more, like, so much money. You know what I mean? And so they're not going to just fly also their expensive helicopter all the way up and just drop it off on a mountaintop without seeing what's up there first, right? Mm-hmm. And the maneuver units didn't want to go out until we actually had guns in place. And so what my section's job was going to be for my unit was we were going to go out and we were going to clear the area and pull security while they landed the guns and then shot their mission. And then once they pulled the guns off, then we were going to get picked up and go. Which the reality of that is we're getting dropped off in what's probably going to be the most convenient for the mission of other people, but we weren't told if, you know, they were taking into consideration if they were going to be people in that area, how safe it was going to be for us, what kind of resistance we were going to meet, you know what I mean? We could have been dropped off into somebody's backyard. And from their point of view, these people have been living in this area for thousands of years. They've been fighting invaders for thousands of years. They run up and down mountaintops taller than the mountains here in flip-flops every day. And if I was in their position and strangers were dropped off into my backyard, I would not let up. You know what I mean? And so the reality of this deployment was weighed very heavily on me, and I consider myself very lucky that the mission for us did get scrubbed. They ended up going with heavy artillery. So after I was able to get out, I was going to get stop lost, which is where you get basically they freeze your enlistment end date and they extend it so that they can keep you on for mission important things. Like for me, it was so I could deploy. Mm-hmm. I was supposed to get out of the military in December, and we were going to deploy in November. So they were like, yeah, we're just going to keep going for deployment.
So much for the contract.
Yeah, so much. Yeah, exactly, right? Well, that's the thing is once you actually join the military, the reality of it is you know, whenever you're a civilian, you are your own person. You have your own rights, right, for the most part. In the military, that's not true. You do not – the Constitution does not pertain to you. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? You do not have the freedom of speech. You do not have the right to bear arms.
Yeah, like, you. Were you allowed to, like, I guess be political is the thought, is the question I have, but I don't think it's that, like, easy.
Not on, like, a public forum. Like, I wouldn't be able to do this if I was actively in the military. Right. You're not supposed to speak about politics in your unit.
Like, how did you feel about, like, potentially going to somebody's potential backyard in Afghanistan? Like,
so that's kind of the weight of promises that you make as basically a child that you have to fulfill whenever you're an adult, right? So whenever I was 18 years old and they told me, like, you know, after my... 3 months of, like, basic training and AIT or whatever, you know, now you're a barrel-chested freedom fighter. You know what I mean? That's what every 18-year-old wants to hear, at least for me and my group of friends. We all joined the military.
That kind of propagandization is so prevalent. Oh, it's everywhere.
Yeah, it's that. Oh, yeah, Call of Duty, G.I. Joe.
I'm much older. I grew up when there was the active draft.
Yeah, oh.
Okay, so I expect, it was part of my upbringing that before I entered the world, I would be a soldier. Elvis got drafted.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Everybody was going to be a soldier, and so they gave you all the toys, they gave you all the G.I. Joes, and it was just all part of your upbringing.
Yeah, they never tell you. The whole time I was in the military, they were never like, yeah, like, good on you for going over there, and you're going to free these Afghani people, and you're going to give them clean water, and you're going to make sure everybody has rights, and you're going to go to Iraq, and you're going to do the same, and it's going to be great. That was never, ever mentioned once. Anything that we were ever told and that was drilled into us was, hey, you're going to go there to make sure your buddy, your best friend, goes home and kisses his wife. That's why you're going there. Or your buddy goes home and kisses his husband, you know.
Which is a kind of honorable thing. It's also a candy coating on it.
Yeah, it really is. It is. And it's a dark thing because it makes you wonder, well, then what's the whole point of us actually? Like, why does my friend have to possibly save me from death? And why do I have to do the same for them?
Yeah, why are you there in the first place?
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, and these people, like, they become like your younger brothers and older brothers. You know what I mean? Like, at the time, my MOS, the job that I had, it was only men were allowed to join. And so, like, I just felt like they were, like, my brothers. You know what I mean? And whenever we had, like, they started integrating women into combat arms. And so we started having, supply people who would come in that were women that come into the unit and stuff, then they became like my sisters. I spent more time with my guys in my section than I did at home with my wife and child.
He's 5 foot 2 and he's 6 feet 4. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.
But you mentioned earlier about, like, having to, like, buy your own equipment.
yes.
Like, I don't know, provide for yourself.
So that
how cheap everything was made.
Oh, yeah, everything. There were so many times where that's the one thing I was so excited about the military joining. I was like, man, I'm going to get all this cool equipment. All this stuff is going to be great. My M16 that was issued to me in basic training was from the Gulf War, and it had Kentucky windage on it. And so what that means is you have to aim up and off somewhere. You can't actually aim at your target because of wind, but I would joke it's because the end of my rifle was bent. And so I'd always have to aim over the right shoulder of whatever target I was firing at to hit it in the center. No matter how much I sighted it in, no matter how much we checked it and stuff like that, it was just bent. When I got to my unit, a lot of our vehicles were held together with zip ties. Multiple vehicles would be out of commission for months because they were waiting on parts that were on back order.
How does that happen?
Well, it happens because the way, it, like I said, it's like the DMV with guns. If you think about it, any kind of government, like most government interactions I've personally had, usually involve a lot of paperwork. A lot of that paperwork gets lost, and it takes a long time to get what seems to be a very simple thing done.
There's, like, on a macro scale, there's just so much money, and there's so many resources in the American military.
That's the thing, is that's kind of the big question, right? And I feel like that's kind of the thing that they're starting to find out right now. I like to pay attention to the news a lot and what's going on. What I've seen, like a lot of articles have been talking about, is now they've been sending over a lot of U.S. like weapons, like tanks, light fighting, armored vehicles, and stuff like that. And they're actually really getting to like test out and see how these things work against their counterpart. You know what I mean?
Where are we sent to?
Ukraine.
Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Yep. To fight the Russians. And it's interesting because some things are performing very well, like the Bradley, which is like this like mini tank, which is just supposed to really like move people around, and it's got like a big old like chain gun on it. It took out a tank. Two of them took out a tank, which is really surprising to most people because that's not what it's for. But also our tank, which is supposed to be this awesome tank, is I think like six of them have been destroyed already. And so in which none of them, if I remember correctly, none or very few were destroyed in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And so, you know what I mean? That kind of tells you, like, a lot of this equipment isn't really as great as it's played up to be. The plates that went inside of our plate carriers, the bulletproof vests that you have on, they were supposed to be able to take an impact from a rifle round, like small arms fire, but what ended up happening, what we were told by our chain of command and people who had actually been deployed, the plates are so cheap, whenever they get hit, they end up crushing your ribs or stopping your heart. And so you can end up with bones in your lungs inside of, you know what I mean? So the bullet may not actually penetrate you, but the damage will still kill you. The rounds will ricochet up the plate, and they'll end up going into your chin, into your feet, into your legs, all kinds of different places. And that's not even to mention, like, explosions. You know what I mean? IEDs are very prevalent. So we would have to go and buy our own aftermarket stuff to put inside of our plate carriers. You know, we'd have to get our own water sources and things like that. I know that, for example, like the boots that they issue you, you know, I went in with high arches and I came out with flat feet. And a lot of people, once you get in, the first thing you do, once you get out of basic training, is you go and you buy, you know, boots that are within regulation, but like boots from private company. And it's because a lot of stuff that they give you is terrible for you. The first day I went to basic training in Oklahoma, the first day there, everybody got extraordinarily sunburned. The second day they gave us sunblock. And the third day they tell us whenever you put on the sunblock, whenever you're sunburned, it gives you a skin infection. And so you're almost like, you're like, is this intentional? But there's, I had a little bit of an inkling because my great-grandfather Mickey, great man, rest in peace. He was in the Korean War, and he fought in the Pacific in World War II. And he told me before I went, he always called me son. He said, son, never trust anything government issued. I guess there was a guy that was, they used to be on torpedo boats. And so there are these plywood boats with these large engines on them. And they would drive up to Japanese boats, and then they would fire torpedoes at them, turn around, and try to drive away as fast as they could. Mm-hmm. And he had one guy on his boat that was horrified of sharks, terrified of them. You know what I mean? Had like an honest phobia, should not have been in the Navy. I don't know why, but worst job for this guy. And so they issued them at the time these shark repellent tags you could hang off your uniform. And apparently this guy fell in the water and was immediately started getting swarmed and attacked by sharks. Like, there was nothing they could do to save him. And that he was like, never trust anything government issued. But at the same time, I was like, all right, you know, Grandpa Mickey, that was a long time ago. You know, things are different now. You know,
my dad gave me the same story. He was in the Pacific in the Army. He was doing mop up on Okinawa, and he ended up stupidly. His lesson to me was never volunteer for anything.
Yeah.
And he went into caves with a flamethrower to torch remainder Japanese.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, so now his lesson was never volunteer for anything.
Yeah, nope.
Interesting.
The LSTs, the landing crafts. Yeah.
Those are really dangerous to
Yeah. Very dangerous. Yeah. He was a very damaged man.
Yeah, probably very stoic, I'd imagine.
Oh, yeah.
That whole generation was damaged.
Yeah. Well, they went through a lot. Yeah.
So, how, I mean, like, you entered the military willingly.
Mm-hmm.
What changed after, or like during or after, to like bring you kind of like to where you are politically? Because I know you're very progressive, like you're part of Farrell, like you're a socialist. Like where those things don't really compute in my mind.
Yeah, I think honestly, it's kind of just seeing it's getting your heart broken, you know, by the G.I. Joe American dream. It's going in and expecting to be with all of these highly trained, well-equipped, professional people that are doing things for good. And finding out that you are with people who are very well trained, they are not well equipped, they are not well funded. There's a lot of humanitarian missions that the military does that a lot of people don't know about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you're expected to be going and doing all these things. During the hurricanes that we had there, whenever I was in Savannah, we had to be on standby as well to go and assist people in Savannah if the like waves got too much and started flooding the city and things like that. And assist the National Guard, who was stationed in the area at the time. And so, and you know, like hearing my dad told me a couple of stories from his time overseas of just trying to help people. I really just wanted to do that, and getting in and finding out that it's not about helping people. It's about filling quotas, and it's about making sure that this person looks good for this person. And it just becomes a big popularity contest, or at least in my unit it was. And you know, you see all these people who could really benefit from good leadership and could really benefit from help that are instead just being chaptered out. At the time, the military was downsizing. This was like 2014, 2016. And we had a guy who tore his bicep while he was working out in the gym. And so he needed surgery to get his bicep fixed so he can go back and do his job. Seems very simple. Our commander has to sign off on it because that's how the military works. You don't actually have any, you know, personal decision over yourself, even with surgery. And our commander refused to sign off on a surgery, and instead they chaptered him out because he could not complete the physical fitness test. Because he had a torn bicep, of course. You know what I mean? The guy couldn't lift his arm above his head.
Oh, my God. That's like slavery.
It, well,
you know? Oh, my God. My slave broke his leg. So now what am I going to do with him? I'll have to sell him for something else.
Yeah, it's what it comes down to. And, you know, you find out, like when I was in basic training, we had people who were getting, like, actually in trouble. It's called an Article 15, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's when you break a law, it's the maximum. It's called a 30-30, so it's 30 days of, like, labor, basically, mind-numbing labor, like painting rocks, sweeping parking lots, things like that. And you do it from, it's usually, like, 5:30 a.m. until 11:59 at night for 30 days straight. And a lot of the time, you don't get paid. You get stripped of your rank. And people were getting Article 15 punishments for getting sunburns in basic training, and the reason was damaging government property. And that made me realize, oh, I am literally government property. I am
their own sunburn was government property?
Yeah, their skin. Skin, your bones, your body. You are government property whenever you sign that contract. If you talk to any veteran, I promise you they got bad knees, they got bad feet, and a bad back. You know what I mean? A lot of times shoulder issues, too. You know, a lot of it is because, you know, whenever you get injured, because you're working out every day, right? Every single day. Sometimes, whenever I first got to my unit, we worked out 3 times a day, you know, and whenever I say, like, we worked out, like, we didn't really, like, we went to the gym sometimes, but a lot of the time, it's like, you're sprinting uphill, you know, in, like, a full combat uniform, and it's lunchtime, dude. And, like, it was because the sergeant that we had, my chief, he was actually amazing, brilliant man. All the people that were in his section, I got moved out of his section to a different one, but everybody that was in his section, he required that you went to college because you had free college courses while you're in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And he required that you had the highest physical fitness score that you could have. But everybody that was in his section was also promoted. You know, he made sure he took care of everybody. He made sure everything, but physical fitness was big for him. And so whenever you're doing all of these things every single day, your body starts to wear down, you know. And I feel like that in like other positions, like whenever you're a competitive athlete and things like that, of course, you know, you can let people down and stuff, but you are not legally required, I feel like, in a lot of things to actually go out and do these things, even though it's actively harming you. I tore both of my rotator cuffs running across firing points with fuel cans full of diesel fuel as a punishment, and was forced to, living literally in a swamp for 2 weeks doing that with torn rotator cuffs. Once we got back, like the next day, we had to take a physical fitness test. And I had to take a physical fitness test and do as many push-ups as I could with two torn rotator cuffs. And it was excruciating. I think I maybe did three. I could barely do it, and I was reprimanded for failing. And then whenever I went to seek medical care, it was whenever you're doing all of these things every single day, your body starts to wear down, you know. And I feel like that in like other positions, like whenever you're a competitive athlete and things like that, of course, you know, you can let people down and stuff, but you are not legally required, I feel like, in a lot of once we got back, like the next day, we had to take a physical fitness test. And I had to take a physical fitness test and do as many push-ups as I could with two torn rotator cuffs. And it was excruciating. I think I maybe did three. I could barely do it, and I was reprimanded for failing. And then whenever I went to seek medical care, it was misdiagnosed as tendonitis. And you don't actually get to see doctors in the military. You get to see, it goes by like rank. So whenever they get out of medical school, they get out of, they don't get their doctorate. They usually come in as like a lieutenant. It can change. Some people can come out with a doctorate and go in, but usually go in the higher rank. But usually we would just see people who had just gotten out of medical school and wouldn't have a lot of experience.
What
and
is
then
the point? Like, why?
Mm-hmm. Well, because it's cheap. It's quick. Oh, it's God. A great place, you know, because people who want to be able to get out and use their degree and pay off their medical debt, especially life as an officer in the military, can be nice, especially as a medical officer. You know, some have very stressful jobs, but some work 9 to 5. You get every holiday off. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It can be a very, and you can't get sued if you misdiagnose somebody. You can't get fired. You know, it's a great place for people to like go and learn. And it's not always the best and the brightest. So a lot of the time it can be different sometimes. And I was misdiagnosed grossly. And the captain who was poking my shoulder whenever I had two torn rotator cuffs, he brought a medic over and he goes, "Come here. Let me show you what tendonitis feels like." He's like, "You take your finger and you dig it there in your shoulder," and they're digging their fingers into my rotator cuffs, and I'm like trying to get them off, but you can't yell at them because you can get in trouble for that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like actual trouble. And so you kind of got to like...
Well, they're officers, aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, the medic wasn't an officer, but the guy who was teaching the medic was an officer. He was a captain. So that guy could have called my captain, who was my commander, and that could have made my life miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Or gotten me out of the military. And not in a good way. So you kind of have to just grin and bear it. But, you know, I thought about it later whenever I had to fight for years to actually get an MRI even. And then they went, "Oh, wow, you tore both your rotator cuffs. And it looks like they healed back pretty bad." And I just thought back to that guy teaching that medic that was what tendonitis felt like. And so this other guy who's learning from this guy is just going out and misdiagnosing all these other people. You know what I mean? And it's just this, like, constant rolling effect. And these are really the reasons why I wasn't really left or right-leaning growing up. I was pretty much a centrist, but I definitely started leaning much more left after having these experiences.
Oh, my God. It seems like a real magnet for anybody who's like this.
Yeah.
Petty tyrant.
It is. And the thing is these people are – it's encouraged, you know, and a lot of the time people are promoted off of how they perform on a physical fitness test. It has nothing to do with how good of a leader you are. It has nothing to do with – you know, how good you are at your actual job itself. It's about how fast you can run, how many push-ups you can do. That's why I wanted to wash my hands of the whole organization. I saw so many good people that could have done good things and would have made great soldiers and were really there that wanted to do the right thing that were just, you know, mishandled by people. As soon as I could get out of there, I was like, you know, and I'm not getting any life skills that I could use, you know, besides like leadership skills and things like that, and just experience and can-do-itiveness, but, you know, it's not the same as going to college for my particular job. And so I was like, what can I do to just kind of get away from this? You know what I mean? Because at any time, and there were multiple times where I would think, you know, oh, great, it's the weekend, I could hang out with my family, get to rest, you know what I mean? And I would get a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning, and guess what? We're going to the field for 2 weeks, you know what I mean? And before we do that, we're gonna go on a 12-mile ruck march, and then we're gonna take a PT test. And then you get to live in the swamp of Savannah for 2 weeks. And I'm thinking about all my friends who are, you know, in college, are having fun, and they're, you know, exploring all of their pursuit. I like to compare joining the military like becoming a father. When I became a father, I expected this wave of wisdom to wash over me whenever I was 20 years old. And, you know, my daughter was born, a week went by, 2 weeks went by, a month went by, and I realized there is no wisdom washing over me. I am just the same person with a lot more responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what the military came down to, you know? It's not... I don't know, I didn't feel like this super amazing, awesome, special person who was working with all these great people and doing good. I just felt like the same dude that was just trying to survive this thing that I was in, you know?
Mm-hmm. All because you wanted the GI money to go to college.
Yeah, yeah, I just wanted to go to college. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know, you know, it's funny, I have it now. I really haven't been to college. but it's, yeah. No, it's a... It was an interesting ride, but you meet a lot of great people. As they say, pressure makes diamonds. You know what I mean? You have a lot of fun experiences. And you get to do a lot of things you could never do anywhere else in the world. You know, okay. I got to shoot a grenade launcher machine gun. That was cool. That's one of my favorite memories. You know, that was...
You can do that in Southeast Asia, too.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Yeah, I can't afford the plane ticket, man. You know? Yeah.
2014, incidentally, I was traveling around Southeast Asia and paid the last of my dollars to shoot an M16.
Oh, nice.
Oh, really?
And it hurt my shoulder.
Yeah? Really? Wow.
I don't know. I don't know what that probably was doing.
Yeah.
It also wasn't, it was not straight.
Yeah, yeah, there's, well, yeah, well, God, who knows what kind they had over there.
It was like, old.
Is it, yeah, it was
it
old.
Was old.
Yeah.
yeah, wow. It, like, reminds me of the thin blue line, like all cops kind of protect each other kind of vibe. And like what you've been saying, just like these kind of jobs attract a certain